People are getting their news from more places than ever during a time when traditional media is struggling to survive. Joining us today is Voices River City podcast host and journalist Dave Kempa to talk about the future of the news media and how it will affect us all. Dave, how has traditional journalism in Sacramento fallen short of its audience?
Starting hard. So I think media in general in all corners of the country has fallen short in a number of ways. One of them being that it's always been sort of a single direction conversation. You know, we in the ivory tower of news set the agenda. We tell you what the story is and you respond to that, you the people. I think it needs to be more of kind of a community-oriented space. I think the population should have more of a say in how the agenda gets set, because historically it's been mostly not just the newsmakers out there, right? The billionaires, the politicians, you know, your celebrities. Also, it's been, you know, media outlets. And then, of course, this third part, I think, would really help democratize our discourse a little bit better. I think it's become hard to do that because historically our business model in traditional media has been crumbling ever since the rise of the internet in the 90s with our good friend Craig Newmark starting Craigslist out in the Bay Area. The business model little by little has sort of fallen for traditional daily papers. So you see that happening with McClatchy in that, you know, their advertising dollars aren't coming in the same way they used to. Our Facebooks and our Googles are eating all of that up. And so they're unable to pay their journalists. They're unable to have a fully staffed media newsroom, which affects the entire community in any city, including Sacramento. Go ahead.
I was just gonna ask you, is that a phenomenon though that is mostly concentrated in traditional media? The alternative press, as in our own local Sacramento News and Review, whose publisher has been on the show before, has recently struggled as well. So is it more legacy press, or is this just pervasive throughout the industry?
Yeah, well, they're both print. And I think that's really the connecting factor with your alternative weekly and your daily paper. Jeff Von Kanel, the publisher of the News and Review, is probably the best in business person in the alt weekly world, because we've seen alt weeklies just fall left and right. Our biggest names, you know, in the history of that game, the Village Voice is no longer really a thing. The LA Weekly has really been decimated. And so the Sacramento News and Review is really one of the last ones standing, but it still has the same issues with the traditional advertising dollars model. And the same problems that the internet poses to your traditional daily paper.
Now, your platform, Voices River City, has a different business model to it. Just in brief, tell us what that is and how that is, at least for you, more sustainable than the traditional advertising model.
Absolutely. You know, I'm no businessman, first of all, and you know that about me. But I really do want to be a part of the conversation of how we can create something sustainable. Our model with Voices River City is a membership model. And what that means is the vast majority of our content is free. You can access just about all of it. But we ask if you believe in what we're doing and if you think we're helping move the conversation forward, you pledge $5 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month through our Patreon. This is similar to a lot of the aspects of your CAP radio, your public radio model, your PBS and PBS affiliates model, right? People believe in you. And so they say, yes, I'd like to give X amount of dollars, you know, X amount of times a year. And I think that that's really a good faith model. I don't think the subscription model has worked as well as we'd like it to. Subscription being most of our content is behind paywall. Maybe some of it is not. And that's sort of to, you know, sort of lure you in to getting a subscription. I would prefer our media to be a little bit more accessible to your worker, to your average person, to your lower class person.
Well, it raises an interesting question. And what is it that people are going to hear regarding the news, quote unquote, and local issues on Voices River City that they're not going to get if they take advantage of free media right now, like KCRA or any of the other media organs out there that we rely upon. How are you guys different?
Yeah, well, I guess I should begin that traditionally, when we launched this 3 years ago, there was more of a traditional style to it. We had straight news, we had arts coverage, we had community commentary, a lot less editorial on our end than you would think. But, you know, it was really about having a news outlet. Our current iteration with the podcast, and as we're going to be moving more into traditional news once again, now that we've got more funding to work with, but now it's, I guess we have the luxury of the podcast model, and that is low barrier. It allows you to sort of wear your heart on your sleeve and, you know, maybe say some words you can't say on your KCRA.
Well, actually, that's where I'd like to go is, okay. is what are the big issues that you on your platform and others with similar platforms are covering today, where it is that the legacy media, for whatever reason, has not?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with issues facing the lower class and people who traditionally
like
have not been able to find a voice on a, let's say, an op-ed section of your daily newspaper. So I think the Black Lives Matter movement, I think Black liberation has really been able to thrive a lot better than if we still existed in this system without without sort of non-traditional web-based media. I think Occupy was kind of the beginning of something like this, like 10 years ago, where they sort of created their own platforms, right, to talk about economic injustice. I think there are issues like immigration and, you know, the rights of undocumented people in California, that it benefits for them to be able to speak their piece on platforms that they've created or that they trust and that they've come to trust over time because they feel like this platform is reflective of what their community believes in.
So go a little bit deeper. Why is it that those issues are being surfaced in your journalistic community and they either have not gotten coverage or enough coverage in the traditional media? What's behind that?
I think there's a barrier. I mean, well, first of all, our U.S. media has traditionally been pale, male, and stale, right? So older white men sort of running the show, determining the discourse. And I think that there are a lot of blinders that you have, and you don't see your privileges, and you're not able to see things from the perspective of somebody experiencing homelessness or something like that. So you don't prioritize those as your storylines on your TV show or in your newspaper. I think as media, and you know, and by that I mean sort of this grassroots media, gets to gain more and more ground, you are having a lower barrier for people of lower classes, people who feel, you know, scared that, you know, the feds are going to take away their grandmother, who are feeling empowered with this sort of new media, right? I think as also, you know, a secondary part to it, we're still, you know, we non-traditional media are still in the same ecosystem as your traditional dailies and your traditional radio shows. And I exist, I have friends at most media outlets, and it's a relationship. You know, I'll have people on our show that traditional outlet folks will come to me and say, hey, that was a phenomenal guest. You know, could we reach out to them for our show? Or I'll have, you know, it actually something like that happens often. Actually, and two of our hosts actually are in the news all the time now too. You also have where we can't go out there and do reporting as regularly as your daily journalist. And so we rely on the reporting efforts of your Teresa Clift at the Bee or your, you know, Raheem over at the Sacramento News and Review. So I don't wanna like say that we are so very, very different. I think we're just seeing a new ecosystem, and we are one element of this new ecosystem.
And it begs the question, does the alternative press, as it's traditionally been known, really still exist today?
Wow. So I think you and I have talked about this before. The way we used to discuss alternative press has changed too. So alternative press to us used to mean your Village Voice, right? And some of those alt weeklies. But we look back on them and we kind of wonder how alternative, how progressive, how different were they really? Or were they run by kind of the same people of the same demographic that were running your New York Times, right? So Norman Mailer was one of the people who started the Village Voice, and there were a lot of problems with that guy back then, you know? And it's something I think we tend to forget. So yes, it still exists. Yes, alternative media still exists. I'm not sure how alternative we want to call a alt weekly anymore. And maybe your, you know, formerly your Gawkers and your Deadspins are something more alternative, you know, where people are a little more free to be freewheeling and really, really push people in power. I think that our current ecosystem, for all the warts that it has, I think it does provide space for people to really speak truth to power in a way that we haven't seen before.
Incidentally, you know, when you talked about the structure of the traditional media, you talked about pale, male, and stale, I think was your quote. It does come to my notice that you happen to be a white male. You're not probably that old, but
I'm not going to look like this forever. Yeah.
How do you reconcile the fact that, at least based on your assertion of pale, male, and stale, you kind of fit the bill on that as well? Should you even be doing the reporting?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, right? And should I even be doing, maybe not. What I think I should be doing, though, is acknowledging that and stepping back. I don't think what I'm saying is, you know, if you're white, if you're a man, you should not be in journalism. There are plenty of really great cis white male reporters out there. What I am saying is we need to acknowledge that and acknowledge the damage that that has done to an industry like ours. And what's very important to me, and what was very important to me when I first launched Voices River City, was to make sure that it's not my voice and it's about community voices, which is why we named it what we did. Go ahead.
Well, that raises another interesting topic, which is, there are certain stories that tend to dominate the press and others that are underreported. Based on your observations within our region, what is the underreporting on the issues you identified earlier related to immigration, Black Lives Matter, the other things that you've raised? What does that underreporting tell us about the power structure of this region?
I think it tells us, well, you know, I don't want to start getting into, because I don't really entertain conspiracy theories, right? Like, I don't think there is this evil cabal that's saying like, oh no, we won't cover indigenous issues. Like, it's just, if for some reason, these aren't prioritized at, you know, your daily paper or in your editorial room. And people are, we're all products of our, first of all, our history, but also our surroundings. So maybe there is, again, it's back to that blinder element. Maybe people don't know it's as big of an issue until the people on the streets force the issue on them, you know? George Floyd brought thousands of people to the streets of Sacramento, and suddenly police brutality was front and center in Sacramento as an issue for 2 months. So I think that also speaks to the importance of having the community.
Wasn't it, though, also with Stephon Clark?
Yeah.
That brought people out as well. What was different this time with George Floyd than Stephon Clark?
I think both were very powerful, first of all. It's hard for me to even speak to what was different. I don't think I know the answer to that. But I think that each of them, within the context of their time, pushed the conversation forward a little bit more, move the chess pieces forward a little bit more. And I think they were both deeply important in their own way. You know, we had AB 392 pass, which we never would have thought would have been real a year before it passed, you know.
Remind us what AB 392 was?
That was the one, oh God, now I'm having trouble remembering it. And I'm not allowed to call up my Google Chrome.
No, well, are you talking about the piece of legislation that changed the definition of what protections police had?
Yes, that was it, yes. And so that one, obviously, you know, it moved the ball forward. I don't think people felt, even on in the demonstration side, that was anywhere as far as they would have liked things to go, but it moved it forward. We also had another bill. I might get this wrong, so I don't want to name it, but I think it might be SB 1421, which went directly at the police officer's Bill of Rights, which that was third rail in California politics until Stephon Clark's death. So these moments, these painful, traumatic moments in our community, they leave open sort of the possibility for change in discourse. Can I come back to, you were asking me about, you know, the blind spots within the upper echelons of our media scene. I think there are a couple things that we still don't cover well locally here in Sacramento. And I just wanted to name two of them.
Sure.
One of them, just the issues facing our indigenous communities, and that's just locally and in California. I don't think we have nearly enough coverage on that. And you know, these are some of the most impoverished communities out there. And number two, I think the threat of ICE and DHS against our undocumented community, it's severely underreported currently because it behooves folks who are in danger of getting picked up by the feds to be quiet and to hide. And I think we need to be more proactive in that. And that I include myself in both of those.
And is that because of the people that essentially command the newsrooms and decide what issues to cover? Or in this case, is it more what you said earlier in the show, that the community's interest is less in those areas than some others?
I think there might be an out of sight, out of mind element to it. I think this is something that you don't think about as, you know, a top editor or as a publisher, because how many indigenous friends do you have? And are you living in the same neighborhoods as them and, you know, your land parks and your East Sacks? There's also a newsroom diversity issue. And I think the more diverse we make our newsrooms, from the bottom up, our reporters can start covering things that are important to them. As an example, we had a reporter of Asian descent, or I believe it might have been a summer intern at the Bee, and she wrote probably one of the most moving things I've read in months in that paper. And she went around and interviewed survivors from the U.S. dropping the atomic bomb in Japan, and just talk to them about what their experiences were like and just the violence and the terror that they felt. And does this get reported on if you don't have, you know, a Japanese reporter in your newsroom, Japanese American?
It kind of speaks to who's got the controlling decisions. And on a macro level, I'm curious, from your perspective and that of your colleagues, who in Sacramento, and I'm asking you to name either institutions or individuals, who has power and who doesn't? Name two of each.
Who has power and who doesn't? And you mean in our media apparatus?
No, I'm talking about you report on the powerful in Sacramento. Mm. And so what we want to know is who, from your estimation, truly has power to set the agenda in Sacramento, and who does not?
Yeah, well, I think that's constantly shifting, and I think we're actually having a seismic moment right now. So on the one side of who has power, I believe, I know you have some friends in these spaces who would disagree with me, but it is the moneyed interests, you know, and it very often is a real estate developer, a powerful lobbyist group, and of course, obviously, like our politicians who have power that has, you know, allegedly been given to them and entrusted to them by the people by electing them, right? The other side of that, I also think that there is a rising people power, a rising popular power. that I don't think we would have seen a Katie Valenzuela on the Sacramento City Council if not for this sort of rising organizing movement that has taken place over the last 4 years. Who doesn't have power? I would say it's the communities that do not have the access to speak their piece. And when they do
such as
speak,
whom?
Yeah, well, let's begin with people experiencing homelessness, right? We have, I probably at this point, well over 6,000 people experiencing homelessness in our county. They can't just, write an op-ed in the B. They can't just, and they don't even, someone who's in complete survival mode, it's less important to them to get out there and tell your story than it is to, figure out how I'm going to eat today, figure out where I'm going to sleep tonight, where I'm safe from, literal physical danger. So I guess who's not in power is people who very often are just in survival mode.
I'm curious, turning to you as an individual, you are a decorated and awarded journalist, yet you decided to take this path in what I will call, at least, alternative journalism. So why didn't you take the route to go to a mainstream paper like, the New York Times or the Bee or someplace like that? Why did you decide to make your home in reporting on the other side of the spectrum?
I sometimes wonder that that's like a personality flaw of mine or something. That there are inherent characteristics of mine that just couldn't exist in spaces like that. So I think what you're talking about is after graduate school, I received a Robert F. Kennedy Award for journalism for some work I did in Mexico. And soon after that, at the time I was working at Thomson Reuters at their mothership in Times Square. I was doing some work actually on their enterprise side, writing a monthly newsletter on trading throughout the US or throughout the world. So global trading numbers and stuff. So I won that award and I ended up, getting a tour of the Washington Post from a former professor. I remember I was interviewed at CNN Money. But soon after that, I started wondering, particularly at Thomson Reuters, who am I helping here? And I know where my personal principles lie, and they lie in the old principle, and it's not written in stone in journalism, but it's something I truly believe in and what I try and build my work around, which is comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And that just means, it's like in comedy, punch up, right? And at Thomson Reuters, I was not doing that by helping traders with, here are three levels of trading in the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange, right?
Well, it raises a question though. Is what you and your colleagues in this ever-changing structure of what is media, are you engaged in journalism or opinion making? In other words, there's the Edward R. Murrow position where it is that historically, we just tell the facts, we leave it for the public to decide.
Right.
But to be frank with you, Voices River City and other platforms like it have a distinct point of view. Is that really journalism?
Ooh, I like that question a lot. In our current iteration, the podcast itself is, I would call it news commentary. Sometimes we do make news and other outlets will latch onto it. But very often it is commentary oriented. I'm not going on the show and saying like, I'm doing straight news, folks. I obviously have very strong opinions on the show. I think once we start doing straight news on the site again, I will have to rein that back personally, although I hope my three co-hosts do not, because they're very fun to listen to. But what we are doing is mostly news commentary, I would call, on the show. The first iteration of Voices River City, it was news and opinion sections, and we sort of, parsed them out in the traditional sense. But I want to get down to what it means, you were talking about Murrow, I think we can also talk about, you know, Pulitzer and sort of the traditional American media and the concept of objectivity. Objectivity is impossible to attain. Everyone has a perspective, everyone is subjective, and you as a journalist, I would, in my school of thought in journalism, we should not shy away from that. We should not ignore that. We should acknowledge it and trust our readers and our listeners to understand our point of view and use it as they digest the material that we're giving them. I think that people are smart enough to be able to do that. Writing straight news, you can remove yourself mostly from a story. And with a great editor, it doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, socialist. It doesn't matter if you have a good editor and you do the news process, you can still tell a straightforward news story. It's still important though to realize that there is subjectivity there. Who did you interview for this story? Who did you give the first quote in the story? Who did you give the last quote to? What statistics from a third party that is an expert did you use? Or are you giving statistics from a think tank somewhere, right? So we need to be more, within media, we need to be more real with ourselves on if objectivity is really possible. I think it's okay to strive for, to reach for as fair as possible, but it's just not, you know, it's like reaching for the sun, you know?
And I think that we will leave it there. We'll be tuning in and listening. And that's our show. Thanks to our guests and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syfax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.